From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The highly anticipated first day of public hearings in the Democrat-led House impeachment inquiry took place on Wednesday, with testimonies from George Kent, a deputy assistant secretary at the State Department, and William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and currently the top U.S. diplomat in that country. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff laid out his goals for the hearings. And before he could get opening remarks from the two witnesses, he was interrupted by several House Republicans. Kent and Taylor eventually appeared to confirm the gist of what the original whistleblower was alarmed by, that President Trump was hinging U.S. military aid to Ukraine on a political favor to investigate Joe Biden. They also confirmed a number of irregularities, such as Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani's disturbing role in setting foreign policy, and how Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch was improperly pushed out of her position. Republicans attempted to deflect the conversation to conspiracy theories about Democratic wrongdoing, which Kent and Taylor seemed at a loss to respond to. We turn now to Ron Fine, the legal director of the group Free Speech for People. He's a constitutional lawyer who previously served as assistant regional counselor in the U.S. EPA, and he's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of the book The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. We've had him on frequently to talk about impeachment issues. Welcome back, Ron.
It's good to be back, Sonali.
So here we are, the first day of the public hearings happened Wednesday after Democrats were pressured to actually make these hearings public. They took place. Some would argue that there weren't any huge bombshells, although in particular, there was one instance that gained a lot of attention, and that was William Taylor, who has pretty impeccable credentials, revealing that one of his aides overheard Gordon Sondland, the U.S. Ambassador to the EU, speaking with Donald Trump at a restaurant about extracting a political favor from Ukraine in exchange for the military aid. As far as I can tell, so far that's been the biggest bombshell that appears to confirm the basis of the impeachment. What are your sort of overall impressions of how things have gone on this first day?
What's important to know is that this has been the first day of public impeachment inquiry hearings, but that doesn't mean that it's the first time we've learned some of this information. So a lot of what we heard from both Taylor and Kent, the other official who testified, is consistent with what we've already learned from deposition transcripts from them and from other officials who've testified privately in the impeachment inquiry so far. The big picture is broad confirmation from multiple officials, including several appointed by Trump himself, that President Trump led and directed a orchestrated effort to pressure, bribe, and extort the government of Ukraine into publicly announcing what were ultimately spurious allegations or investigations of his principal domestic political opponent, or so he thought, Joe Biden. And he used his office to withhold military aid that Congress had already appropriated to send to Ukraine for its defense against the Russian army as leverage in that effort. And everything that we've learned so far is consistent with that broad theme.
Let's actually take a listen to what it was that Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chair, said in his opening remarks, because I think that part is important, because in opening these hearings with these remarks, he laid out what his and the Democrats' goals were in the impeachment hearing, goals that Republicans appear to not want to grasp. Here is Adam Schiff.
Presented by this impeachment inquiry, or whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability and invite Ukraine's interference in our elections, whether President Trump sought to condition official acts, such as a White House meeting or U.S. military assistance, Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his re-election campaign. And if President Trump did either, whether such an abuse of his power is compatible the office of the presidency. The matter is as simple and as terrible as that. President's chief of staff confirmed Trump's efforts to coerce Ukraine by withholding aid. When Mick Mulvaney was asked publicly about it, his answer was breathtaking. "We do that all the time with foreign policy," he said. "I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence foreign policy. That is going to happen." Video of that confession is plain for all to see. The issue that we confront is the one posed by the president's acting chief of staff when he challenged Americans to get over it. If we find that the president of the United States abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, or if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally to conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, must we simply get over it? If the president can simply refuse all oversight, particularly in the context of an impeachment proceeding, the balance of power between our two branches of government will be irrevocably altered. That is not the founders' intent. The prospects for further corruption and abuse of power in this administration or any other will be exponentially increased.
And those are excerpts from the opening statement by House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff on the first day of public impeachment hearings that took place on Wednesday. My guest is Ron Fine. He's a constitutional lawyer who's written a book about impeachment. Ron, how important was it for him to lay out these issues? And I know that progressives differ and sometimes disagree with one another about the U.S.'s position on Russia and exaggerations of Russian aggression and whether Ukraine is innocent. Setting aside conversations around foreign policy and national security issues, because that is certainly worthy of debate in a separate conversation. Setting those aside, how important was Schiff's underpinning of these impeachment hearings about the potential of abuse of power and also the obstruction of congressional oversight?
I think it's critical because a lot of people have not tuned in fully to all of the details of what's going on with this Ukraine scandal. Maybe they've heard a little bit about it, but this has been the first televised impeachment inquiry hearing. And in doing so, Chairman Schiff laid out the case for the American people as to what President Trump did and why it's wrong. And the facts are becoming increasingly harder to refute. And the president's defenders are now retreating to smaller and smaller and sometimes crazier ground in trying to argue why it's not worthy of impeachment. But Chairman Schiff laid out the case as about as simply as one can, that the president abused his power by using our tax dollars as a weapon to try to harm a political opponent, and in the process, dragging the Ukrainian people into it.
One of the defenses that the Republicans appear to be employing is that the witnesses don't have firsthand knowledge of some of the things that they're claiming. For example, Bill Taylor, in saying that he heard that his aide told him about a conversation that he overheard. So they're claiming that this is secondhand knowledge, but those who do have firsthand knowledge are being blocked by the White House from testifying, right?
That's right. They're trying to have it both ways. I mean, first of all, I should say that that Taylor and Kent and many of these other witnesses do have firsthand knowledge of maybe not every conversation that Trump himself was personally involved in, but they participated in conversations with Ukrainian officials and with others like Sondland, where these issues of bribery and extortion were being played out in real time. But the others who would know even more about this, like Mick Mulvaney, like John Bolton, former national security advisor, have been blocked by the White House from testifying. So if the president's defenders really want to hear from the people who have firsthand knowledge, then they should allow them to testify under oath.
They're also undermining these hearings by claiming that their witnesses aren't being allowed. But I understand that the list of witnesses turned over to the committee chairs, and this is all part of the rules of how committees are run. That list of witnesses includes the original whistleblower, who they keep fixating on, as Trump has, and also Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. Do you feel convinced that Schiff was correct in refusing those witnesses?
The list of witnesses that the Republicans provided included several who were already on the planned list of witnesses to be called, and Schiff said he was happy to call them. And then as well, some of these totally extraneous witnesses that are intended really to create a sideshow. The whistleblower is a particularly striking account because the whistleblower essentially here is functioning as an anonymous tip. I mean, once the whistleblower initiated this process, the investigation moved on, and it's not necessary at this point to know who the whistleblower is or to get any more information out of the whistleblower because we have other people with firsthand knowledge. We have not an exact transcript, but a summary of the phone call between Trump and the Ukrainian president. We don't need to hear anything from the whistleblower, and to expose a intelligence community whistleblower's identity when they followed the proper whistleblowing process would send a terrible message that would prevent other whistleblowers from reporting abuses within the government. So I think it's really damaging for them to try and seek to expose this whistleblower, who at this point doesn't really have anything more to add than what we can get from witnesses who are now fully prepared to testify before the committee.
Right. I mean, the contents of the whistleblower's complaint is not something that they should fixate on, because the core argument has been confirmed and reconfirmed several times by people who have put their names out there. So the only reason for going after the unnamed whistleblower is some sort of political payback for starting the ball rolling. They seem to want to be out for blood against this person who, triggered what has now played out. But it's very possible that what is now playing out might have come up through other channels, given how many people are willing to publicly talk about it, right?
Yeah, and I think the attempt to expose the whistleblower is an attempt to divert attention from the failings of the President of the United States and towards this individual whom we don't know anything about, but maybe, you know, this person, I don't know, smoked marijuana in college or something like that, and they want to use that as a basis to attack the whistleblower and make it as if the whistleblower is the one in the dock, whereas it's the president whose misconduct is being investigated. And again, the whistleblower brought the matter to light and talked about the phone conversation that Trump had with the Ukrainian president in July and some other events that have now all been confirmed by other witnesses and by the White House itself. So we don't need to hear anything about the whistleblower's identity, and it can only serve to create a distraction and a terrible precedent that would prevent people within the government from reporting on government misconduct.
How damaging is Mick Mulvaney's press conference, where he basically said that, admitted there was a quid pro quo and that people should get over it, although he didn't do that in sworn testimony? Those words have continued to crop up, and Mulvaney, who has been subpoenaed, has refused to show up. He certainly can't backtrack on his words because they're out there, and now he refuses to testify. It seems as though that's a pretty big and pretty damaging issue that, again, Republicans don't seem to want to address.
That's right. And if they want to hear from somebody with firsthand knowledge, Mulvaney was deep in the heart of this. It's important to explain when he says that, we do this all the time. That's just false. All the time, what can happen is that the president or the U.S. government makes some condition that's in the United States' interest in exchange for another country doing something. That does happen all the time. But here, what Trump has done is he has imposed a condition that's in his personal political interests in exchange for another country doing something. And it wasn't even authority he had to withhold that aid. That aid had been appropriated by Congress, and he was required to give it to Ukraine. So what he's done is not something that happens all the time. This is an an abuse of office where he's really misused his position to use our money as leverage to accomplish a personal political vendetta against what he assumed would be his political opponent.
And just as an aside, of course, Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, is very much at the heart of this issue as well. Giuliani has tried to stay out of the spotlight, but he published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on Monday, or I believe it was Tuesday evening, where he just, you know, his defense of Trump was that only a few lines in the entire transcript of the call with Zelensky focused on Joe Biden. But, you know, honestly, that is enough, right? Just because he didn't spend the entire phone call on it doesn't undermine that he spent a small part of the phone call on this very important and incriminating issue.
That's right. And the key points in which that conversation pivots involve this issue of investigating the Bidens, where the Ukrainian president talks about wanting to get access to defense aid. And Trump says, and I'm only slightly paraphrasing, first you need to do me a favor, though, and says you need to, you know, investigate the Bidens and announce it. And the rest of the conversation that comes before and after it is establishing the context for that request. And that is the key part of the conversation.
One of the issues that the Republicans did bring up, Devin Nunes, the highest ranking Republican on the Intelligence Committee, in his opening remarks, brought up the special counsel's investigation, Robert J. Mueller's investigation into Russian interference, you know, basically saying that the Democrats made all these claims about collusion with Russia only to find that that didn't stick. So now they've switched their tune and they're moving on to Ukraine. What are the problems with this argument? And is it possible that the Democrats did pin too many hopes on the Mueller investigation?
First thing I should say is that the Democrats didn't initiate the Mueller investigation. Mueller was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, who was Trump's handpicked number two man at the Department of Justice. So it was the Trump administration that initiated the Mueller investigation. Having said that, there is an argument to be made that there were some people who put all of their hope in the Mueller investigation as if it would expose all of the wrongdoing of the Trump administration. And what we saw from the Mueller report was that it certainly showed obstruction of justice in terms of the president's interactions with Russians. It showed misconduct, whether, you know, it's enough to convict the president of a crime is a question for debate. But the key point is that the Mueller investigation was only ever about a narrow set of abuses. It wasn't about the president's receipt of unconstitutional emoluments from foreign governments. It wasn't about the many ways in which Trump has tried to abuse his power outside of that context, such as by directing law enforcement to go after his political opponents long before he tried this with the Ukrainian government. And so the focus in some quarters on the Mueller investigation probably wasn't helpful in the long run. But the key point is that it's not part of some master plan to bring the president down. The Mueller investigation was initiated by Trump's appointee Rosenstein after Trump fired the director of the FBI. So he brought that on himself.
And the issue at stake is, that came out of all of that was obstruction. But yeah, this investigation took so long. And then in the end, with Mueller's sort of reluctance to spell out what needed to be spelled out and William Barr seizing the narrative, you know, right after the report was released, it definitely was more of a whimper than a bang. Well, let's turn to some of the issues that you just brought up, which is Trump really has committed so many impeachable offenses. And here we are talking about this one issue around Ukraine, a pretty clear-cut issue, it seems, and a pretty damning issue. But your organization joined with a number of other organizations to write up articles of impeachment, progressive articles of impeachment that you submitted on the first day of these public hearings. Tell me about these articles of impeachment, your sort of wish list for what he should be impeached for.
the impeachment by the people articles that we've presented cover a broad range of Trump's impeachable misconduct. It includes Ukraine, but it includes much more. And these include things like abuse of office to direct law enforcement to harass and investigate his political opponents and the press and to undermine the freedom of the press. It includes corruption of electoral processes by his misconduct in the 2016 election, not only with respect to Russia, but also in making hush money payments unlawfully to buy the silence of women that could have revealed damaging information about him. And it also includes his misconduct with Ukraine and also asking the government of China to interfere in the 2020 election. It includes some of his abuses of office to promote discrimination, hostility, or violence on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin. It includes misuse of the armed forces and abuse of emergency powers, which he's done at the U.S. border with Mexico and in the conflict in Yemen, where Congress has directed him to withdraw U.S. forces, but he is continuing to keep them in hostilities there. And it includes obstruction of justice and of Congress. And when you put this pattern together, you see a larger pattern that goes back, along with, of course, the emoluments, which began on day one of his presidency with corruption and self-enrichment, that he has, since the very beginning of his presidency, viewed it as a tool for his own aggrandizement, and the laws and principles and norms of the Constitution be damned. And the reason that we introduced these articles is to help broaden the conversation so that, yes, it should definitely include Ukraine, but it should not be only about Ukraine.
Right. And I just want to pick up briefly on two of the issues that the articles point out that have relevance this week alone. The issue of providing aid to and comfort to white supremacists and neo-Nazis. We've been revealed through leaked emails just this week that Stephen Miller, the advisor to President Trump in the White House on immigration issues, communicated with Breitbart in the months before the election. And those emails were filled with the promotion of white supremacist and white nationalist literature. And of course, the issue of cruelly and unconstitutionally imprisoning children and their families. We found out this week that nearly 70,000 children, just an unimaginably high figure, 70,000 children have been separated from their parents this year in the past fiscal year 2018 to 2019. 4,000 remain separated. So just huge issues, none of which are being raised in these impeachment hearings. Well, finally, let me ask you this, Ron. Trump is likely to have it to be impeached by the House, and being impeached is essentially like being indicted. The Democrats hold a majority in the House, a significant majority. Through these hearings, it's likely that they will end up with impeachment. Then it moves to the Senate, and Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas who advises the Senate Republican leadership, just said there are not enough votes in the Senate to immediately dismiss articles of impeachment as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to do. It requires just 51 votes to dismiss them. Republicans have 53 seats in the Senate, but now they're worried they won't get 51 votes. So there may actually be an impeachment trial in the Senate, right?
I think that's right. And I'm glad to hear that Senator Cornyn has acknowledged that the American public deserves to have an open impeachment trial, and that the Senate should not try to poo-poo this or rush it out the door, but rather hold a trial as they have in past cases, most recently President Clinton, and then take their votes. And the American public deserves to know where their senators stand.
And I just want to mention that on Friday, there are going to be more witnesses that will be giving testimony publicly, still to come over the next several days. Our testimonies in public from Vindman, Sondland, Volcker, and others, and we will cover those as well. Ron, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Give out a website where people can find out more about the work you do, as well as those people's articles of impeachment that you mentioned.
Yes, it's all available at freespeechforpeople.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Ron Fine, legal director of Free Speech for People. He's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of the book The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. We've been discussing day one of the public impeachment hearings that took place Wednesday. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.